Welcome to Earth Matters, a weekly show that discusses environmental and conservation issues that affect us here in Grant County, around New Mexico, nationally and globally. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. The Gila Resources Information Project, also known as GRIP, is a nonprofit environmental organization that works to promote community health by protecting our environment and natural resources here in southwestern New Mexico. Along with the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance and Center for Biological Diversity, GRIP is also a partner in the Gila Conservation Coalition, also known as GCC, which works to protect the free flow of the Gila River and the wilderness characteristics of the Gila and Aldo Leopold wilderness areas. GCC organizes the Gila River Festival, which is an annual celebration of the Gila River, New Mexico's last free-flowing river. This week on Earth Matters, we'll be broadcasting author Craig Child's 2012 presentation at the 8th Annual Gila River Festival entitled Water Course: Conversations with a Moving Element. Craig Childs writes about the relationship between humans, animals, landscape, and time. His stories come from visceral personal experience, whether in the company of illicit artifact dealers or in deep wilderness. He has published more than a dozen critically acclaimed books and is a commentator for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Men's Journal, Outside, and Orion. At High Country News, he's a contributing editor, and he teaches writing for both University of Alaska in Anchorage and Southern New Hampshire University. He has won several key awards, including the 2013 Orion Book Award, the 2011 Ellen Molloy Desert Writers Award, 2008 Roel Art of Adventure Award, and twice he has won the Sigurd Olsen Nature Writing Award, first in 2007 and then this year in 2013. Childs is an Arizona native, and he grew up back and forth between there and Colorado, son of a mother hooked on outdoor adventure and a dad who liked whiskey, guns, and Thoreau. He had worked as a gas station attendant, wilderness guide, professional musician, and a beer bottler, though now he's primarily a writer. He lives off the grid with his wife and two young sons at the foot of the West Elk Mountains in Colorado. About Craig's presentation last year at the Gila River Festival, he writes, quote, "No matter where we live, our world is laced with water that is constantly in motion. Glaciers collapsing off the coast of Greenland belong to the summer rain that falls on the Gila and muddies the river's course and runs eventually toward a sea it never reaches. And wherever it goes, water tells a powerful story. This talk takes you on a tour of adventures and discoveries in water from the Gila to the rest of the world and back again. I hope you'll enjoy Craig Child's Water Course, Conversations with a Moving Element.
My name is Donna Stevens, and I am one of the organizers of the festival. This year's theme is The Wild River Speaks, and we're featuring stories about the Gila from different cultural and natural history perspectives. Several years ago, my friend Rinda put a book into my hand and told me I had to read it. And I'm a big reader, so I said, okay. And that book was The Secret Knowledge of Water. Hand for the book. So I got hooked pretty fast, ordered a copy for myself, and passed it around to a lot of people. There's a whole group now of Silver City people who've read Craig Child's books, and we really wanted to bring them to the Gila River Festival. We've tried for 3 years. This year, he finally said yes. I think it was partly so I could quit bugging him. Craig Child says that he travels the interstitial places, and I am going to let him explain what that means tonight through his performance. He writes books about archaeological thievery, the ancient memories held in wide rivers, and what it's like to wander around the driest places on Earth. He has written more than a dozen highly acclaimed books, such as House of Rain, Finders Keepers, Soul of Nowhere, The Animal Dialogues, and his very latest, Apocalyptic Planet, which is so new you cannot even order it on Amazon yet. Craig is a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition, and he lives with his wife and two sons off the grid in western Colorado. We're really honored to have him here with us this evening, so please welcome Craig Childs.
It rained. How long do you wait for it to rain? How long do you look up at the sky and watch the clouds move around, crossing the horizon, and you wait for it to rain? You look out and you see Virga coming down over the desert, not touching, and you wait for it to come. We follow the rain here in land like this, in places that are dry. We follow wherever it goes. We watch it come. We watch it leave. Sometimes we end up in these blue holes where it seems like no matter where you go, it just doesn't rain. This blue hole in the sky just follows you from place to place. And in many parts of the world, they think that's wonderful. They think the dark cloud that follows you around is the ill cloud. But when you live in certain parts of the world, you understand that when a dark cloud follows you around, it's a blessing when it finally rains. In these last couple of days, it rained, and sometimes there were those big, fat, silver dollar drops that hit the rocks and make the boulders look polka dotted. That kind of rain. All you have to do is walk outside. All you have to do is just get a little bit on your face. It seems like every time it rains, we should all be getting wet. We should all open the door and step outside and look up just to get a little bit of it, at least. Or maybe just get soaked, where it's pouring out of your pockets and down through your pants, and you are just wet with rain. You want to talk about singularity. You want to talk about bonding with something. That is one thing that you can bond with. We are, what, 3/4 water in our bodies? That is what gives us our softness. That's what makes our cells plump. That's what allows us to walk, is all this water inside of us. The last couple of days, we've been drinking it. And I say we because whoever is under that rain, we are all there together. And it moves through the land. You watch it cross over the mountains. You watch the creeks come up. You see the color change, and you can name the different tributaries and what's coming down through the burn and what's coming down through old burns, what's coming down through clean forest. You can name all the water that you see because you can trace it back, because you know the place, you know the land where it's raining. Maybe that's why you follow the rain, because it's the bond, because it's life and water mixed together. You're a supplicant begging at the sky, begging that the bond never breaks, that the rain keeps on landing on you. You know, I've been traveling in extremely dry places looking for water. I don't really know why I do this, but I do. I assume a lot of you do the same thing. You go out there looking for places, looking for those dry, craggy, hard spots, looking for some sign of water. I have been looking for water in some of the driest places in the world, where it is just the sun burning into you as you cross the landscape. This being the Atacama Desert in northern Chile and Bolivia and Argentina, where the countries come together, the driest non-polar desert in the world, where in places it has not rained for centuries, where you walk across this landscape and your shadow just cuts out across the rock, and there is nothing out there but earth, but solidness. You can't see water anywhere. Even the sky sometimes is so absent. Maybe there are clouds coming by, but it's all sand and rock. And then you see something that was once alive. And it matters out there to see some scrubby bush that maybe has been dead for decades. But you see it and you go, water. A sign of water. I mean, you walk out there across the Atacama, and there are times that that you don't see a living thing for 4 or 5 or 6 days, and I mean you don't see an ant, you don't see a fly, you don't see a blade of grass. There is nothing out there but this open land and salt, a ground made of salt where you can actually eat the ground, you can put it in your mouth, you can taste it. Everything is dry out there. But there are signs of water, not just these old dead things out there. You're walking across the desert and in one spot you find a bush out there in the middle of nowhere. And you understand why, like, there'd be a burning bush story, because you see something like that and you just go, God! And you go walking across the horizon to get to it. It is tapping water from somewhere. You walk across the salt and you see these patterns in places where water has been running, where it's actually coming off these mountains in the background, these 19,000-foot volcanoes that catch snow on occasion, and the snow melts and it runs down into these big flat salars, these open spaces that just go on for horizons. You walk down across these and it is just this mad landscape of salt. Just carrying your pack over these things, climbing, scrambling, looking for the next step. And then, in the middle of it, you find something. You find water. In the driest place on Earth, you find water. You find where that snowmelt has gone down to the bottom of the salar and collected. It's not water you can drink. It's far, far too salty. But it is water. What is it about water in these dry places? It draws your eye, it draws life, things gather around it. Even the salt around this water changes form. You get down and look at it, and it looks like it's alive. The salt looks like it's some kind of marine creature growing out of the ground with the water. What is it about water? Whatever it touches, it changes, and it's always moving, flowing down from these mountains into these pools, evaporating back up into the sky, leaving crystals inside these water holes, salt crystals growing in these little spots. We found a place out there in the Atacama where the water was actually welling up out of the ground, out of one of these salars, right about in the middle where the water pressure would be pushing it up through the salt. And it was coming up and flowing across the surface, forming a river. A river in this dry place. Where at night, it's cold and the water that you're carrying, your drinking water, freezes. And in the morning you get up and you walk and the sun comes up and it is just blazing and you can hear the sloshing ice in the back of your backpack, and around you the mirages start spreading in the morning, and then it starts to get really weird because pink flamingos come to these water sources to eat brine shrimp. And so if you can imagine the ice sloshing your pack as you're moving and these silvery mirages spreading in front of you and these weird gangly pink flamingos flying overhead, it looks like it's too much. But this is what it is. This is what water does. It creates a place. Out in the middle of desolation, it stands out. It draws your attention. Something about water, when it's so limited, is so powerful, so different. You can't help but go to that place. So let's go to the other end of the spectrum. A place made of nothing but water. About a year and a half ago, I landed in Greenland on the ice sheet. And this is a completely different picture of water. This is 684,000 cubic miles of water in its frozen state, sitting on top of Greenland. This is a very different experience getting out there, because there is no rain. This place is a desert, much like the Atacama. The snow there blows in from the 10,000-foot summit on the other side of Greenland and just blows down across the surface of Greenland, leaving these shapes all over the surface, these beautiful feathered shapes. And you look at it and you say, that is water. That is water too. Water telling its story in the form of ice. And it's always moving. Water in this form of ice actually weighs down on the surface of Greenland. If you're flying in from above, it looks like it's all flat. But then as you get closer, you see that there are these big swells that go on for miles. The whole landscape is undulating. What's happening there, right where this plane is landing, the ice is about 6,000 feet deep. Underneath that ice, there's a mountain range. Now, ice doesn't stay put, it moves, because in a way, it's still liquid, and it's flowing over that mountain range, and standing waves are setting up behind the mountain range. So you have all these long waves arcing across the Greenland ice sheet, and it's the waves of motion. The whole place is moving. This camp, I was there at a research station, just a small station for seven people that's been out there since the early 90s. It was first built on the top of one of these waves. Now it's in the bottom because the ice is carrying it along. And in about 5 years, it'll be at the top of the next crest, and then it'll go down. This camp is just surfing on this mobile landscape that's moving about 3 inches a day. And there are times we'd be sitting in the tent just pretending like the G-forces were on us, that we were just all pressed to the wall as our tent was being carried down this rapid that's 6,000 feet deep, heading eventually for the sea. But it's not just movement on this larger scale. You see the snow flying through the wind constantly. The wind is picking it up, moving it around, and it goes behind every object, and it creates these tail fins, these shapes all over the place. If you stand in one place for too long, you will become a sculpture as the snow gathers behind you. This is a fluid, dynamic landscape. You can see the water in the ice. You can see it in the snow. You can see movement embedded into this landscape. Everywhere that you see water, you see movement. The wind blows across it. You have to dig your gear out. And it's always moving, always windy out there. There are just few moments where it's quiet. But for the most part, shapes are being made all around you. You feel like you're walking through this circus of fluid dynamic construction, almost a hydrologic landscape that's entirely white. You leave open a door for too long, and the snow comes in, and it fills up, and it folds over everything. And this isn't snow like the snow you shovel off the sidewalk around here. This is like digging into wallboard, trying to get it back out. This is snow that pats down tight, little tiny grains that are so frozen that they just lock into each other, and you have to break the snow off to get it out of there and carry it out the door and dump it outside. This is water too. Water takes so many different forms. Now, I was out there for long enough that I watched winter go into spring, and spring, summer is kind of the same thing out there. It starts changing by the day until the ice that's been covering the plexiglass window inside the tent finally melts. And you're witnessing this larger change. You're witnessing a seasonal shift as the earth, the northern hemisphere, is tipping toward the sun and things are starting to melt. And as you know, the melt in Greenland is creeping its way in toward the center. This camp used to be above the melt zone. It used to be in a place that was frozen year-round. And after this last experience was the summer before last, this is what it looked like at the camp. The camp is up there. This is an aerial shot of the camp. As the melt moved inland and consumed the camp that has been there since the early 90s, and this is what happened to it. As that water is melting, dropping into crevasses, filling up lakes, dropping down to the bottom of the ice sheet, and lubricating the movement of the ice toward the sea, this is what water does. Water moves. And I was fortunate enough to be there at the moment that it happened. At the moment of the shift, when everything that was ice turned into water.
We'll be right back with more of Craig Child's presentation after this short break. Welcome back to Earth Matters. We're broadcasting author Craig Child's presentation, Water Course, Conversations with a Moving Element, from the 8th Annual Gila River Festival held in September 2012. In this segment of our show, Craig will be talking about the source of the Rio Baker in Patagonia, Chile.
Ice melts. It flows away. It goes down into the canyons. It makes rivers that flow into seas. And I've been looking at these rivers lately. I've been fascinated, especially with rivers that have never been dammed, major rivers in the world that are still running free. And a few years ago, I ran the Rio Baker in Patagonia, the largest river in Chile. And it was a trip where we started up at the where the glaciers are coming off the northern Patagonia ice cap. And, you know, once again, everything is in motion there. Wherever there's water, it is just constant motion. The seracs, these big chunks of ice, calving off the sides of glaciers and pounding down into these scoured, gray valleys. So you're back there, trekking through these valleys, just hearing boom, 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 boom. I remember one night sleeping up in one of the valleys, and the ground just shook underneath my back. And I woke up and it was dark inside of my tent and I wasn't sure where I was. I just felt this explosion, just boom under my back. And I didn't know where, what. And then I thought, oh, serac. And then I heard the boom, 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 boom. All the valleys echoing back. You could count the valleys as the seracs fell. I remember getting out of my tent that night and it was foggy on the floor of the canyon. The valley bowls up above, you could see the stars. And I just stood there in the dark and listened to these sounds in the distance. Faint. Boom. Boom, boom. 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 Ice breaking free. Falling down. Shattering. And you see it during the day. It looks like comet dust. Just a big chunk falling and turning in the air, and they're just exploding against the rock. Everything is moving there. Everything is melting. We followed a glacier back over a pass, a glacier that had been in a valley in the 1970s. Now it's completely gone from that valley. It's retreated over the pass. You could time the retreat of this glacier, because as you're walking up the valley, the trees are getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. So you know you're at year 10, you're at year 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, looking over the pass. And on the other side, what's left of the glacier? Towers, splinters of blue ice falling into these muddy pools. And you get up on top of that glacier, and it sounds, I used to think, oh, glaciers, they must be very quiet, very still. You get on top of them, and they're just roaring, water flowing everywhere. It sounds like ship engines below deck underneath your feet, because rivers are forming in the ice. You see these moulins, these holes dropping into the ice, and water is just pouring down into them, and you take your trekking poles and you get out as close as you can with crampons and just lean over and look, and you see these smooth pinball chutes disappearing down into the blue within blue within blue, a color so perilous that you just want to jump in there. Because water is flowing down inside, and you can hear it. You can hear the little waterfalls just disappearing underneath. You go into some crevasse, and you follow the water, and it just echoes around the corner, like it would in a slot canyon, except it's all blue and smooth, like wet, cold marble. It forms all this water that heads out, that starts these rivers. We ran the Rio Baker from there down to the sea, which was really a wild experience to get on a river that's all melt, all coming out of the snow, this just indescribable color, the color of earth. And I don't mean the color of brown earth. I mean the color of mineral, the topaz turquoise color that when you sweep your paddle into it, you can see the paddle down into the depths. And it is just this amazing color coming straight out of the glacier. And then you run it down, and other rivers are coming in from other glaciers all around you. And that place is just full of water, waterfalls coming down all over the place. I mean, it's like Yosemite must have been at the end of the Ice Age, where there's still glaciers up there and every hanging valley is spilling over, water moving all around you, the constant sound of water, the eddies spinning, and you moving downstream, following this pattern all the way to the sea. It's a powerful thing to go to the sea on melted ice, to follow this process. I did a similar thing in Tibet a few years ago. Ran the upper end of the Salween River, which is one of the major rivers. It runs for 2,000 miles, coming off the northwest side of the Tibetan Plateau and just dropping through all these technicolor waterfalls off the steep edge of the plateau, and you know, just streams coming down from everywhere, only this is a very inhabited landscape, very different from Patagonia, where there you're going down the river and there are prayer flags over every little tributary, and carved stones, images, words, daggered Tibetan lettering carved into all these boulders, that are taking prayers and putting them into the water, putting into the wind, moving them downstream. And when I talked to the monks at a monastery down there, they told me every stream has a different prayer. Every tributary carries different weight. They are all named. They are all known. Even in the most remote country, when we were down inside of a gorge that was 3,000 feet deep, you come out the other side, and boom, there's a big boulder that says Om Mani Padme Hum across it, a prayer. These prayers moving. And I realized, oh, the Tibetans have this figured out. Water moves things, so put your prayers near the water, and that will carry them. And, you know, we spent 7 days at this monastery before we took off. It was because the trip, this part of the Salween had never been run before. And it was about 200 miles of river that nobody knew anything about. The local Tibetans, they knew nothing about what was down there, because you don't go down there. You don't go into those gorges. That's death. And they tried to talk us out of it. And it didn't work, but they did find Sharpie pins that we had, and they started writing blessings on all of our stuff. And so we had blessings on our helmets, blessing on our paddles, on across my life vest it says something like walk in the light, or else in Tibetan it says this buffoon is gonna die. I don't know what it said, but I assume it was a blessing. And we were just covered with them. And at first, you know, I'm thinking, oh, these guys are so kind. They really want us to live. And then I realized, you're just putting prayers in the water. You're just sending the message downstream. And maybe it worked, because it was a phenomenal trip. We didn't really know what was down there at all. And that really changes your perspective when you're running a river. This was kind of a Grand Canyon-sized river when the Colorado is up. And it happened to be flooding. The monsoons had stayed on a few weeks too late. So the river was at peak flood stage. Trees were coming down. It was a dark, muddy river. And we're going into these gorges, and you really don't know. I mean, the only way we figured things out was by looking at Google Earth. And it was right in that really grainy part, you know, those parts of Google Earth where you look at it and you go, what is that? And you'd see the dark snake of the canyon, and you just try to, you'd look for the darker spots, and you go, okay, danger, 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 danger. All the dark places are where we have to really watch out. And you'd go into these places not knowing if it turned into a waterfall, if we were going to have to pull over and get rid of the gear and somehow climb out, or what would happen. When you're coming around a bend, and every inch that's being revealed is it's just like frame by frame. You are staring, you are staring, you are staring. You're watching everything come out to see what's around the corner. Everybody kind of leaning and leaning to see what is there. I remember one rapid. It was actually one of the first rapids that we hit. It was a long day of big oceanic waves and big rapids, class 3, class 4 rapids, which, you know, that's one thing if you know that there's an end to it, but it's very different if you have no idea what's going on. And we were tired. It had been raining hard. We were kind of hugging the shoreline, looking for a place to come in. And the river was just a freight train. I mean, this was supposed to be a two-week trip. It took us 6 days. Because we couldn't stop. I mean, you try to stop. Somebody would go, I'm going to go over there. And then we'd all turn over there. And one raft would get in, and the other one would just bump it right out. And then the kayaks would get squeezed. And it was a mess. And so it was the end of the day, and we were grazing the shoreline, and we came around the corner to this 1,000-foot landslide that had recently gone straight into the river. And so the river was chundering up over all these boulders that you couldn't see. You know, big Colorado River-style hydraulics, but Tibetan-style. A little different. And so we managed to get into shore and kind of clutch onto shore, get tied off, and just looked at it, and it was our first big rapid. And the first decision was, okay, we're just going to ghost the rafts. We're just going to push them in, send the kayaks down, and pick up the carnage. The rest of us will walk. And then after about 20 minutes, we just went, that's not a good idea. So we ended up sending one person down on each raft, and everybody else traversing the landslide. And eventually we got back together downstream. And the rapid was fine. I mean, it was big, but it was fine. But it really changes your perspective when you're going into country that you know nothing about, that really nobody knows anything about. And you go into these deep gorges that tighten up, and they turn dark, and the water at the head of them gets squirrely and wild, and then it gets louder and louder. There was one that was a 6-mile-long gorge, and it was a class 5. That I would say lasted at least 5 miles. So it was this non-stop, tumultuous journey where you're down in the thick of it, and you're not really thinking about upstream or downstream because you can't tell the difference. When you're down in this pit and you just see the crack of the sky above you, and it's just water slamming you over and over and over again. I remember being in this 18-foot self-bailer raft, and there was a woman named Kristen on the oars, and two of us had paddles, and she was shouting at us. We were just jumping around in the raft, backpedaling, drawing, and going down into these holes and crashing through. And I remember that sound as you get down under the water, and you know, for a second you hear everything, and then boom, you're in the water. And you just hear this garbled roar of air bubbles, and then you burst out the other side, and you hear Kristen going, and we would stop. We had two places where we stopped, pulled over into an eddy, which the eddies were almost more dangerous than the main stem of the river itself, because they were just sucking tubes down, and oars were flying around, and we sent two kayaks down from there with radios to give us instructions on what would happen next. And I remember standing there for, it must have been 15 minutes, where we just listened in silence, just everybody kind of on the tip of a boulder going, all right, what's the story here? It sure is quiet down there. And then the radio crackles, and somebody comes on with just this insane set of directions. He's going, left, and then right. You got to go all the way right, and then, I mean right, all the way right, and then you got to come back to the middle. You got to get to the middle. You can't be left or right. And then slightly left of that, and there you'll see the hole, you'll see the boulder, and then be sure to head far right again, and then come to, and it's just on and on and on, and you're going, what is he talking about? And then you get into the water, and you realize he wasn't talking about anything at all. This is just water. This is chaos. This is the stuff. And every wave, you're born again and again and again. Water is just pouring out from underneath your helmet. And you are straining. You are digging. And it is water. Water moving. We got to the end of that river trip, and there was a big bridge. Big communist-style concrete bridge. And these three officials came running out on the bridge because they're wearing their hats and blue uniforms and just waving wildly because they thought that boats and bodies would be coming down. that we wouldn't make it, and they were just so excited to see us. And as we were coming under the bridge, I looked up and I saw this little concrete lip running across the length of the bridge, and on that lip were all these little stones that had carvings in them, where pilgrims had reached over and placed stones all along the bridge. The officials couldn't see it. Only we could see it. And as we were passing below, I saw all these signs, and I realized, oh, these are the same signs that are written all over us. We did our job. We did what we were sent to do. We carried a story down the river.
We'll be right back with more of Craig Child's presentation after this short break. Welcome back to Earth Matters, where broadcasting author Craig Child's presentation, Water Course, Conversations with a Moving Element, from the 8th Annual Gila River Festival held in September 2012. In this segment of our show, Craig will be talking about dams in China and sort of his thoughts on big major dam construction in the world.
When I got off of that trip, I went to the city of Chengdu, China, and I met with a Chinese activist, and we got together in this smoky tea house in the middle of the city, and he showed me on his laptop maps for China's hydroelectric plants, and I didn't ask where he got these, but we started by looking at the screen, and we were down at a level where you could see one river and several tributaries, and the thing was just covered with hydroelectric numbers, with megawatts, gigawatts, whatever kind of watts they were going to get out of it. And then we would back up a little and see the larger landscape, and there's another river, another, and then hundreds more dams, and then back up a little bit more, hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of dams being planned, and then back up all the way so you can see Tibet and China together, and there were thousands of dams marked across this map. And sometimes you just have to back away. You just cannot take the idea anymore. I mean, I know we need power, and I know there are many of us. I know we need water. I know that there are a lot of complex decisions to make, but these rivers are being plugged, all of them. This Upper Salween is the last major river coming out of Tibet that does not have its headwaters dammed. The Rio Baker is this huge river flowing through Chile that is not dammed, although the plans are right now to put in 5 dams on the Baker and the nearby Pascua. And on that computer screen, I saw the plans for damming the Salween all the way up. We're changing the earth. Geomorphologists are estimating that we are actually changing so much sediment flow that we are altering the weight differential of continents. That we're actually putting more weight in one place than another, which is changing the way that tectonics works. We're changing the actual structure of the planet just by altering the way that rivers move. That's how powerful rivers are. That's how powerful we are. Because you know those rivers will break through those dams. You know that they'll fill up with sediment. You know that eventually, I mean, maybe there's no hope for us, but there's hope. Because rivers don't stop. Even if they don't get to the sea right now, they don't stop. They keep moving. You can't stop a river. You can change it, but you can't stop it. So it seems like I've been on this tour of undammed rivers. I've been looking at how they work. This is Tibet and the tributaries coming into the Salween, where you're seeing the different colors of the water coming down, eventually reaching the Salween, which was just this beautiful muddy color. I mean, so many people, when they see a muddy river, you know, I think it's people who are not from the Southwest. People in the rest of the world, they look at the muddy river and go, oh, it's kind of green and brown. And we go, yeah, that's a continent being moved. You're seeing it in action. I mean, you go down it, and you're floating over the movement of the Tibetan Plateau. I mean, this is what a lot of the river was like. I mean, there are placid parts, but you're flowing over a whole continent that's the largest, highest landmass, highest plateau in the world, crumbling and being carried down grain by grain. Rivers move things. They move the world. They move the weight of things. The Tibetan plateau is able to lift like it does to some degree because the water is constantly moving sediment off of it, lightening the load so it keeps coming up. This was that rapid, the landslide rapid. And that beautiful brown. When you see the Colorado River running through the Grand Canyon, that color, or even the deep red where it's coming out of the Little Colorado River, you're just going, yes, things are happening. Water is moving things around. And you get inside of it and it just takes over your life. It just pours over you and it carves its way down and you follow the path. Rivers have this way of just carrying you. In Patagonia, you go to where it starts with the ice itself and then this incredible color, the depth. The river flowing down toward the sea, flowing over lips and edges where you become a feather in the water, where you don't fight it, where you learn to move with it, where you learn to let it carry you. And you go down to the bottom, down into those gorges along the Rio Baker. This is a spot that would be under a reservoir. But you go down there now, and the water is alive. It's moving. And you go onto those placid stretches as it heads to the sea. And it's just amazing to stand there and watch it, to sit in the raft and watch it move. You've gone out to a river, haven't you? A big river, and stood beside it, and just stood there and gone, this thing is just not stopping. It just keeps going. How is this even possible? We live on a planet that's a perpetual motion device, where everything is just going because it's water, because water is moving through the place, because it is rising up into the clouds and coming back down into the rain. I've been on this tour, I suppose, of undammed rivers, which of course brought me here. Of course brought me to a place where the rain is falling. Up in the headwaters of the Gila. And you can smell the different forks. And you can see the way they change by the water running down into them. And I've been up there the last few days where I took these images. And there are signs of water everywhere. Whatever you want to call the signs of water. Pottery, people lived here. They lived here because there is water. A turtle came out. Western box turtle. Heading down for the river. You know, we were probably 200 feet up in elevation from it. And it was on its way. I'm surprised. You know, they move fast. Because you move it over here to take a picture of it, and it's like, now get into the river. And then the river itself, the sign, you know, not wild and tumbling right now, but a mighty creek, full of water, moving downstream. Everything around it showing the signs, the patterns, this dynamic pattern of motion, of changes, of water levels rising and falling, leaving mud behind, carrying down the remains of fires, where you can see it in the middle fork right now, that color of everything entering the water. And I was talking to Dutch Salmon yesterday, and he was saying how after a few years, you start to catch trout about that big in a river like this that has had fire sediment moving down. It takes a while. Be patient. We're here for a long time. We're here to watch these changes. We're here to see how things are affected, to understand this landscape, to walk out into the river and put our hands in the water, to taste the water, to see how deep that sediment goes. And what that sediment leaves behind. There's a lot of nutrients moving down the river right now. Black, dark, You get into it, get in knee deep to it. Things are changing out there. Things are always changing wherever the water moves, where the clouds start to rise late in the day and you see those thunderheads and you hear in the distance the sound. And then it starts. The rain starts falling. You get in some alcove and you sit back there and you listen to it. And then everything starts to move. The drips start to fall off the ceiling of the alcove, and then the drips accumulate and it starts running. This is how it happens. This is how it always happens. We live in a world where there is this animal all around us, water moving, coming out of the sky. Can you believe it? Fresh water falling from the sky? What planet has that? I mean, you would travel great distances to see this. You would travel across solar systems to see a place like this, to watch water, this thing that looks intelligent, that has thought to it as it flows, as it moves, as it picks up a leaf, as it chooses to go around a small rock and go downstream. You see this process happening all around you, and you're there at the moment when it starts moving. You're there in the front of some little flood that's coming down a tributary, and you follow it. It's like a snake, like a cat, like something that is truly alive. This is what we have inside of us. This is what we carry. We are rain people. There's a reason we follow the rain around. I mean, there's a reason you see it coming down and you follow it. Wherever it is, if it's car wash water coming down the street, you're going to follow it. You're going to see where it goes because it is telling a story as it goes. You follow the rain when you live out here. Maybe you don't know why. Maybe you just do it because you have to. You watch the skies. You listen for thunder. You hope for a flash flood. I mean, you hope for it. You really want to see it. You want to smell it. You want to take that foam and clutch it in your hands and just smell the stuff. It's incredible because it's so alive. It's carrying everything. Water is always moving, always carrying. You throw a car into the river and it will carry a car. You throw boulders in, it will carry the boulders and break them down to smaller and smaller pieces. It is constantly working this planet. It's why we're here, why we're alive, why there's a town here. Because there is a river, because there is water. Water comes to this place. Look for those places. Follow the rain. Let it run free. Let it run all the way out. There is something different about rivers that don't stop. Rivers that are not stuck behind dams gathering sediment. And maybe that's just a matter of preference. But it feels different to be on a waterway like that, where you can follow your heart all the way down to the sea. I know the Gila more by the Sonoran Desert, more by the towns, and no water at all. And it is distressing, because you think, this should be going, this should be moving. And you remember that it is moving underground. There is still water down there. There's still a river. You can never stop a river. Never. It will keep going. It will find whatever path it can. And so I've been honored these last days just to be up there, just to be watching it, to be up in the rain, soaked, tilting my head back and drinking. Because when it rains, all you have to do is open the door and walk outside and open your mouth and drink straight from the sky. Thank you for coming.
to all of our listeners for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this presentation by author Craig Childs from the 8th Annual Gila River Festival in September 2012. We hope you'll tune in again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Membris Community Radio.